The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Wow, I didn't believe I'd done all that, accomplished that in my life, no? Thank you very much. Primero quisiera darles las gracias y explicarles que esta presentación, yo nomás estoy sirviendo como el voz del pueblo. I'm only their voice. I'm acting as a conduit to their history because they're the ones that did it, and I want you to know I'm very honored to be able to do this history. I think that too many of us get caught up in this other egotistical world, and we forget that history is made by people, just like yourselves. Thank you. Bueno, I'm going to go ahead and read part of this, the introduction, and then we're going to go ahead and view a 7-minute video that I've produced in cooperation with other Black Beret members, and then read a conclusion. Okay, so and I'm still messing with the title, and I think we settled in on American Blowback: The New Mexico Black Berets. Okay, the law of retaliation is an instinctive reaction when one's human rights have been violated. This has been recognized as Lex Teleones, the law of retaliation. It was codified with 288 laws measuring in degree of punishment according to the offense by the Babylonian ruler Hammurabi, etched into law in an 8-foot obelisk some 4,000 years ago. This primitive response lies at the core of human nature. When a person finds themselves in a desperate situation, they will do whatever it takes to survive. Lex Teleones, in its modern form, is known as blowback, a term coined by the CIA in 1953, and is defined as the unified consequences of the state interference in the affairs of communities. That is, when a community is left with little choice for its survival, they will coalesce in reaction to an oppressive state, and collective cells will organize and retaliate in search of solutions to correct socio, political, and economic ills. Interviews. Okay. The social unrest of the 1960s in itself for organizations such as the New Mexico Black Berets gave rise. Awakened by an era of social dissidents, they stepped up for the occasion, demanding that their community be treated equally. The U.S. Constitution is but a social contract made between the state and its citizens. Governments are the enforcers of maintaining order for the state. However, when they grossly violate these mandates, they leave its citizenry with little recourse but to take matters into their own hands. The Chicano community realized that this social contract did not include them. Awakened in mass, a racial, ethnically marginalized Americans mobilized, challenging the repulsive specter of discrimination. The Black Beret organization was under siege. The Chicano community harassed, along with neighborhood associations, the Berets formed community patrols to protest to protect themselves from those very state authorities that were opposed, that were supposed to protect them. Their collective historical experience and personal attacks, murders, unwarranted search seizures at the hands of police, and uninvestigated bombings of their vehicles resulted in blowback. In spite of the ruthless attacks by mainstream society, the Black Berets still managed to capture the admiration and respect of the public and many civic leaders. The Berets pledged a creed to provide service, to educate, to defend their community. They held fast to this by establishing the first community health clinic in the Albuquerque metro area with a mobile unit going to the underserved communities. They started the first breakfast program for youth, which has since been institutionalized in schools throughout. They designed and implemented course curriculum and cultural revitalization classes for both youth and adults. The Black Beret organization emerged at the vanguard of the Chicano movement, participating in the mobilization of its community to gain political and social justice. The Beret's voice acted upon the reconceptualization of an oppressive social order, challenging the hegemonic colonial worldview. The Chicano youth movement historically contextualized their reaction to the culturally erosive, oppressive, and destruction of their personal and social identity. The civil disobedience of the 60s was a form of blowback, testing the state's unjust use of the laws, excessively attempting to maintain the status quo of white privilege. Particular communities had varying concerns of socioeconomic, environmental issues of inequity and uneven political representation. In this context, the rise of the Black Beret Organization of Albuquerque, New Mexico, was but a micro expression of a much larger reaction to colonization of the American Southwest. Nativo Nuevo Mexicanos displaced the displacement from their land base and the socioeconomic and political marginalization of an indigenous people all contributed to the frustration and needs to address the human rights of dispossessed peoples. At their peak, the Black Berets thrived. There were up to 2,000 participants in the Chicano youth movement, representing 5% of the local Hispanic household in the state. They gained popularity and members became articulate in social and personal injustice that remained unchallenged for lack of understanding, fostering civic leadership. The Black Beret organization seized the state's discarded mantle of justice, representing community protection at the front line, championing justice for its community, serving their neighborhoods, instilling pride in la cultura y la herencia, something they had been shamed of expressing in an earlier time. The sequence of events of the Black Berets, aka Las Gorras Negras, began in 1969. The Black Beret organization organized their first public event, a protest march for social justice. This is the incipiency of a social protest movement that is coalescing across the country. Chicanos are on the move, challenging discriminatory practices at all levels of society. I'm going to jump through this a little quicker so we can get through this one. On February of 1971, the Black Beret organization publishes their first of four issues of the newspaper, Venceremos, Papel del Barrio, leaving a historical record, principally of how they were being harassed by police and activities they were involved in the community. On the week of December 15th, 1970, an article appears where the police stopped them for no apparent reason at gunpoint, only to look at their driver's license and vehicle registration. Another reported incident of racial tension between the Stompers and the Chicanos at Rio Grande High School is brought to their attention, and the Chicano Youth Association calls them to help. The police arrest two students, un Chicano y un Americano, who has aligned himself with the Chicano community. They declare before the public that they will adhere to their creed, that is, to serve, to educate, and to defend their community, whatever the cost, following their 12-point platform. Los hermanos de la cofradía de nuestro Jesús de Nazareno call in the berets. They ask them whether they understood the gravity and history of what they were doing and the responsibility they were taking on. They told them of las gorras blancas and that they were carrying on a long tradition of struggle for self-determination, a struggle that Nuevo Mexicanos have been fighting since the American annexation. The notoriety proceeds the Chicano community is coalescing. State officials see them as a threat, yet they gain the admiration of celebrities such as Anthony Quinn and Muhammad Ali. The state authorities are concerned with their popularity and social unrest of an empowered Chicano community. The governor makes it known to the police he wants the spine of the berets to be broken. A special unit is organized between all law enforcement in New Mexico, the Metro Squad. Their purpose is to infiltrate activist organization, cause disruption, promote illegal activity, to discredit the public image of the Black Berets and other activist organizations. Community associations in cooperation with the berets from their own neighborhood patrols ask the police to stay out of their communities. They also present the city with demands of a citizens review board of police behavior in Albuquerque. They align themselves with communities abroad, working with them on issues of social justice, supporting organizations engaged in struggles for economic and environmental justice throughout the American Southwest. Herald as heroes, the Black Beret organization find themselves at the vanguard of defining who and what Chicanos are. They embody what it means to be proud of one's heritage. October of 1970, the Berets police authorities, making sure that the students participating in the walkout at Rio Grande High School proceed without incident. They keep the Albuquerque police and APS administrators at bay, allowing for a peaceful demonstration to proceed. The Berets become principals in the mobilization of other protest movements as they take to the streets demanding that the police be accountable for their aggressive treatment towards raza. Las gorras negras Las gorras negras received pleas from penitentiary inmates to come to their defense. A short time later, riots break out. On October 13th through the 19th, the Berets attempt to speak to the governor and to give him a list of civil rights violations, requesting that a civil review committee is be formed to look into questionable behavior and violations by the warden and staff and all law enforcement. The governor refuses to see them, y las gorras negras sit in his office refusing to leave until they are seen. 8 of the 13 Black Berets are arrested. Shortly thereafter, the district attorney of Las Vegas, New Mexico, Donaldo Tiny Martinez, puts his land up for bail and defends Las Gorras Ocho. November 19, 1971, 11 Gorras Negras attempt a citizen's arrest on the penitentiary warden. They were refused entrance into a public luncheon at the Albuquerque Hilton, where the arrest was to be made. A female beret was to publicly read the arrest warrant. The entirety of the incident was without violence, and the Berets were arrested, leaving peacefully, handcuffed. By June of 1971. I was expecting more laugh. Okay. By June of 1971, the Chicano community is feeling the pressure of the police. On June 13th, the police decide to arrest a young man for drinking at Roosevelt Park. Even though it was commonplace at the time, the police decided to arrest one person. A crowd of several hundred other citizens at the park formed, telling the officer to leave him alone, that all they were doing was enjoying a day at the park. The officer chose to pursue the issue. Las Gorras Negras were called in once again, and they raced up there, attempting to calm the crowd down, and attempted negotiations with the police, who were already in riot formation. They moved towards the police to negotiate when they opened fire, thus beginning a riot. Thus, as they moved towards the police to negotiate, they opened fire, thus beginning the riot. The largest civil disobedience ever experienced in New Mexico. The Berets are seen as a militant organization and are met with bombings of their vehicles. Minutemen send them letters threatening their lives. They find flyers on their door or vehicles with the crosshairs of a rifle telescope saying, "We are watching your every move." The police refuse to investigate. Instead, harassment increases, pulling them over for nothing more than wearing a beret and a gun to their head, threatening their lives. Antonio Cordova is beaten and arrested by the Española police on July 18th, 1971, for photographing and documenting police using excessive force during an arrest. Rito Canales gets out of prison with signed affidavits of numerous illegal activities and civil rights violation inside the penitentiary. Sometime before his release, he is stabbed by another inmate. The jailers have the stretcher set some distance away. He is told to crawl and get on the stretcher himself if he wants medical attention. Rito Canales and Antonio Cordova are assassinated a day before they are scheduled to appear on a television show to speak on the conditions of the state penitentiary and mistreatment of citizens by police. Rito was found with 9 gunshots to the back, and Antonio with 6 gunshots and 1 to the head. Neither was armed. The deliberate attempt to discredit the Black Berets was undeterred. Their popularity and respect for defending the rights of the voiceless was not discouraged. Community support undaunted. There is no stopping them. The coalescence of an awakened consciousness allows for nothing less than challenging a skewed society favoring white privilege. Communities of color are revitalizing ethnic cultural practices that had been forced into capitulation in the past and are now exerting their right to self-determination. The Black Berets support and help organize workers throughout the state, Artesia, Portales, Las Vegas, and Albuquerque, demanding equitable pay and human working conditions. The people are demanding that a white oligarchy step aside and allow Chicanos to take leadership positions in all aspects of socio-political life in New Mexico. Okay. With that, I think I'm going to go ahead and start up the video. It's 7 minutes long, and then I'll close it out with 2 paragraphs that I got here. Okay. The Black Beret organization demanded reform in the penitentiary, forewarning the state of imminent danger 9 years before the prison riots of 1980. Passive resistance is found in the revitalization of ethnic cultural expressions that had gone on, that had gone dormant, unable to express itself, exploding from within the Chicano community, mobilizing to take back their education by beginning liberation classes to develop responsible leaders, disciplined in the learning, in learning their socio-political history. Though La Lucha has been arduous, the Berets have persisted through time. At the front line of transformation, challenging a social order determined by race and color. Though today the Black Beret organization no longer exists, its former members have evolved, impacting educators and civic leaders throughout. Armed not with guns, but with an awakened consciousness, their expectations and emerging ideology empowered the downtrodden. They strove to foster a better world, both challenging the mundane world held by privileged white Americanos. Influenced by the tidal wave of social and political dissidents, the Black Beret organization, aka Las Gorras Negras, were determined to see that justice be dealt with equally, blowing smoke into the eyes of a nation, reminding them that Mexican Americans are not foreigners, but treated as the colonized in their native land. Thank you. Oh, wait a minute. One more paragraph. I forgot. No, I got to give you this one. This is an even better paragraph. Okay. Well, many in this country sat around the warmth and light of a campfire, boasting of living in a democracy. They choke in their hypocrisy. Las Gorras Negras rode the winds of change, blowing the darkened truth to those who sat comfortably around America's campfires. They are no longer a formal organization, but they rose to the occasion, serving their familia, la raza. Paying dearly, some of their members were murdered. Others were incarcerated, harassed, and defamed. Their legacy only to be awakened to challenge the beast of injustice by a new generation of social activists. They will never exist as they had, but their spirit lives on, recognized in the contributions they have made, dedicating their lives for socioeconomic and political justice for those who are disempowered. History will come to honor them as symbolic pioneers. Few have emulated those ideas of Ernesto Che Guevara. He once said, "The greatest revolutionary deed you can commit is to set an example." Y así lo hicieron las Gorras Negras de Nuevo México. Muchas gracias. Now that's sort of a bit of fumbling, but I did my best, guys. What can we, let's open it up for questions. No questions? Thanks. Yes. They were all forming alliances, and that's what I think wreaked the fear of God in the status quo. Because by this point in the civil rights movement, you start seeing other disenfranchised people communicating and talking to each other. And I believe that had things remained its course, we could have seen the next stage was revolution. The way it was co-opted by the state and federal authorities, it was able to squelch the movement. Yes.
I have a question. Do you know where the wrongful death suit is going for
Yeah, they just stopped it dead in the water. The legal system, they just didn't have the way I read those records. They just have they just didn't see any credence in it, and they just stopped it. They didn't. There's some people here that could speak to it better, and they're more than welcome to jump in. Richard is back here, and I don't know if he's got anything he'd like to say about that. Go ahead. Yes.
Were you able to find any CoinTelPro documents or something that helps out with that?
Yeah.
So it would say a line or two, and then it would, you know, one word, and then it would go to something else. And we were very aware politically that we needed to be a little bit cautious, since there was a lot of groups, including the parents and the board, many of the other organizations, that we were working in concert with and coalition with and so on, even those bank periods, that once the freedom of information materials became a tool, you could say, of the movement, social justice movement, then the police forces also figured out ways that they could, in fact, attempt to disrupt those movements. And so you know the American Indian movement and some of the other movements that are following the freedom of information, sometimes they would name a name, and then they would leave it blank for two or three sentences. They would say a name, and then they'd leave it. So it was also, although it worked against them, on the other side of that coin, it also was used to distrust, but to build distrust amongst many of our organizations. Now, there was a suit that was filed along with ACLU and the National Lawyers Group several years back, because we had applied for all the information from the Albuquerque Police Department. And while we were, that was being happened, going through the judicial process, there was a move on the part of the Albuquerque Police Department to burn all those files. And so, for some of you may remember around Tingley Beach, the fire training for the trainers was right there before the new facility was built, was right there by Tingley Beach. It's still, that platform still stands. So our attorneys were rushing literally to that site where boxes upon boxes upon boxes have been piled up to attempt to stop the burn with an order from a judge to cease burning. And it was almost like a movie or something, because they were going in the parking lot, the stuff was poured on it, and they were lit in flames. So there's been a lot of we know that there's still existing materials. I think those that have been working with us on pulling this together, we've started to pull out the North Valve files, the Bruce King files, we need the Cerise files, the Manuel Han files. There's a whole set of people that we still need to go into those files, but it has become much more difficult as the time went by to obtain some of those materials.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question about the community conditions at the time, because obviously what was happening in Mexico, happening in other parts of the country, like, you know, the community were facing all this oppression. And if you can speak a little bit about what were the conditions that kind of motivated the group to start organizing.
The police brutality and harassment was a major issue. Every community, just couldn't go anywhere and do anything without being pulled over. And that really hasn't changed a whole lot for our community even today. You see the sheriffs in the South Valley riding continuously for people and checking them out. That was one issue. The other issue was with the schools. If our kids weren't making it into schools, our kids were dropping out, quitting school. Probably the alternative after that was crime and I think that's prison. And so at the schools, there was no Chicago studies, no ethnic studies. It was all just straight American history and straight American curriculum as such. So there was nothing to identify or with. And I, like any other Chicago students at that time, I tried to get it, tried to assimilate, tried to make it within the system. And I got as far as I could go down. But even here, there were many barriers to be able to continue my education. But when I did finish it, I mean, in spite of all those barriers. The other thing then was also the Vietnam era. We're being drafted since many of us didn't attend college. Most of the deaths of the soldiers in Mexico were Hispanic and Native American. And that was because of the education. through that period, by the far end, and you know, the limbs go off it, pretty much at that point. And since then, it's been basically legal struggles, labor struggles, environmental justice struggles, addressing some of the issues that still continue.
I just want to just quickly just add that I mean, I think one of the key successes, quite frankly, to the Black Rail organization had an incredible community support. And that community support was expressed in many, many different ways. One of those actually was, that was mentioned, that Federico mentioned, was that during one of those incidents, we had the governor's office, that Tiny Martinez, the district attorney of Las Vegas, during that time had put his land up to bail us out, to get us out of jail, to bail us out. But we had all the programs of the Black Berets were funded primarily by community. And there was church, some church groups that came forward, made contributions, there was some other organization. But I think one of the real key pieces to me, as we kind of continue to go back, and there's several activities over the next several months that we'll be involved in as we continue to build this up to its 58 minutes and some of the other things that are going to go along with it. One is that the real lack of child care that was taking place here a lot during that time and still is today, quite frankly, because the circle is reinventing itself. Many of our young mothers, single parents, single women that are household, and the real lack of one, the need for them to go job, to go work, to gain income, but at the same time, then how are they going to do that in terms of child care facilities and all that they're not hungry. The lack of health care, as it says here, we opened up the first health clinic in the South Valley, in all of the valleys of Albuquerque, and you can see some of the results of that this many years later, and we'll continue talking about it. We opened up the first dental clinic that was opened up in the East San Jose community. We occupied a facility there that was a brand new, it had all new dental equipment in it, and was x-ray equipment and everything else that had been sitting there, basically closed down by the city of Albuquerque. We asked the city of Albuquerque for that facility to donate that facility to us. They refused, and we occupied the building. We stayed in the building for 7 to 10 days, and then they finally turned it over to us. We opened up the dental clinic with volunteer technicians, with volunteer dentists, and so on. Our clinic, the Bobby Garcia Clinic, and Judy Espinosa, many of you may know Judy. Judy was the Secretary of Transportation under the United Administration, Secretary of the Environment under the King Administration, and most recently was the lead staff person to the Lieutenant Governor, and now is the Director of the State Fair. You may have been reading about the last over the rodeo or that kind of thing. But Judy was a medical student here, a nursing student here at UNM, and we put out the call in 1967 and 1968 asking for young volunteers or volunteers to come forward in the nursing fields, in the technical and technician field, as doctors and so on. So all of our facilities were run and managed primarily and controlled by community. We opened up the first cultural schools that were said and spoken to. When we surveyed our neighborhood, because many of us said if we're going to form a new organization, then that organization needs to be grounded in the hopes and the desires of the people in the neighborhoods that this organization is being built for and that our membership is made up of. And so as we surveyed those communities, they said that we needed to educate our younger people to the histories of communities and the history of movement, the social justice movement, and this kind of thing. So we opened up, we And so there was a lot of things that we were engaged in. We opened up a wood cooperative, the dependency up in the mountains, because people weren't putting wood in their fireplaces only to be pretty during the summertime and put the air conditioner on. Many of our people still today are heating by wood, by cooking by wood in many of our villages and communities throughout the state. So we opened up a wood cooperative in conjunction with many of our sisters and brothers in the mountains of Tennessee doing so. So there was a lot of program that the Black Berets participated in. But if you add that, quite frankly, to the time, the moment of the history of the war in Vietnam, what was happening in the state, what was happening in the region, what was happening in the country, what was happening in the world, as we continued to educate ourselves and to be very clear that we were not a localized movement, but we were a national movement that had international connections, then based upon that, then very clearly to many in this city, and we had a lot of elected officials that were allies then, and still all of our allies of ours today that support this project and are going to continue doing it. So it was quite here on campus. You all know, 1967, 1968, Santiago mentioned he was a student here. We participated with other students here to fight UMAS, the United Mexican American Students, and then we formed a coalition between the students and between the community, because this little glass castle sitting up here for years and years has always attempted to separate itself from our communities, and quite frankly, we pay the same taxes on this institution as anybody else does, so we deserve as much from this institution as everyone else does. So based upon that, we forged student, worker, community coalitions and so on. You may remember here in 1967, 1968, the workers went on strike, the physical plant workers. So there was a lot of interaction between college campuses, between students, between professors, between academics, between other professionals, and grassroots people. And this regular folk that are trying to do the best for the communities. So that's kind of where we are. We haven't changed much in all these years. We've just gotten a little bit older. We can rename ourselves and maybe the Great Berets instead of Black Berets. We don't want to take it away from the Great Panthers either. But I will quite frankly just say to you all, as we continue to build this effort, that the majority of us that are still living are still active in our communities and are still active on social justice issues. We gave our lives up then, and we'll give our lives up today, because what we believed in then is the exact same thing that we believe in today. And it's all about trying to make this city, our state, this country, and the world a better place for all of us to live and work, and that's what we're up.
For all the work that you've done as part of this movement. And you mentioned, Richard, some of the records that still have not been done, and this continues to be a movement of really gathering that information and imparting that information to those who don't know it, right? Because there remains not just at the local level, I'm sure even here in Albuquerque or in Mexico, but certainly nationally and locally, people that don't know about this. What has happened and what has continued to happen, this really is living history. And it's something that the Office of the State Historian very much would like to continue supporting in many different ways. And in terms of the archives, I think as mentioned this at the beginning, this is precisely what this program is all about. Supporting research being done. And right now we have three categories, people who are working towards a graduate degree, people who hold a graduate degree, and independent scholars. And so anyone who doesn't know about this program, please ask us or go to our website and know that this is something that we're supporting, the research being done in any archive in New Mexico. So if there's any way that we can continue supporting that, the movement, this is why we're here. At this moment in time.
that we don't even know about. So we certainly would support that. The vision is those records probably also exist beyond the political boundaries of what is now known as New Mexico. And we would continue wanting to expand that research support wherever the archival research is. The second way that we want to expand it is obvious because archives tell us certainly part of it, but wisdom also sits, continues to sit with the people who have been part of these movements. And so we want to, right now we're only supporting research in the archives, but if I get our, my way, if we get our way, we're going to support it also ethnographically collecting all history. So stay tuned as we continue to move this forward. But thank you. Thank you everyone who's participated in this video. Thank you for this talk and for the work that you have done in collecting some of these stories, many of these stories over a long period of time.
And if I may elaborate on what our state historian has just said, that it is of critical essence that we look towards the voice La Voz del Pueblo for our history, because these kind of counter hegemonic movements are not recorded in state archives. I mean, they aren't captured in state documents. You know, some of the papers that I've gone through in the King file, for example, I mean, there's like four or five folders full of letters of concerned citizens after the riot condemning and basically going after our Lieutenant Governor, Roberto Mondragon, saying little about, you know, David Norvell's role in the accusations of inciting the second day of the riots. You do see as you go through those letters, many of them handwritten, if not the vast majority of them, you find an occasional, maybe I think I've only found like three letters that are in support or that were supporting what the Black Berets were doing and in attempting to keep some sort of, to keep people out of harm's way during the riots and dealing with the issues that the Berets were bringing to the forefront. So that's telling you that our people don't write their history down, but they carry it in their hearts. You know, and that's where we got to go for it. You know, we're not going to find it in documents or very little evidence of really what's our conceptual worldviews of our experiences of being colonized and exploited. And the only way that we can offer an accurate lens that truly reflects the conceptual views of our community is by listening to our people and having respect and honor for their collective wisdom. So, you know, I'm happy to continue to take more questions. If not, well, just
I just wanted to mention now as we kind of finish up is that we said earlier that this is going to be, and I really want to thank the state archives. I got to really say that because our folks here have been extremely helpful, not only in terms of helping us in some respects with some financing to be able to go through that, but at the same time, I mean, just you know, kind of leading us in directions, places in some cases that we didn't think would be there. lot that still is to be given back to our people in terms of much of the history. So there's a lot left to this. We need your help, we need your support, we need your ideas, we need your encouragement. This hasn't been easy, as you can imagine, because some don't want to see this happen, quite frankly. Some just don't want to see it happen. And going back into to history and so on, in terms of files and different kind of things that we know, and actually they know too. And I'm saying they, meaning many of those that were responsible for the intention, agitation, instigation, whether it was through infiltrating of not only our organization and causing destruction, intentional destruction, and the assassination of several of our members, but on the other side of that, there's much of this story to be told, and history will continue to speak for itself, but that history will be spoken for itself by those that participated in the history, and that's what we're really all about. So you all mean a lot to us in this effort. We're going to continue to do small things. We'll get a re-edit of this 7-minute piece that'll be in tomorrow. Some things will be lightened up, some things will be changed, there'll be a few more subtitles underneath and so on, because things are changing very, very rapidly for us. And you all know yourselves, as you do volunteers, everybody did a hell of a good job, and we really do appreciate that. But, you know, we're doing it kind of, because when we said we're going to do it, and we said we're going to do it, whether we got the resources to do it or not, we're still going to do it. And so that's just where we are. I want to thank you on behalf of the Black Brigade, those members of the Black Brigade. That'll be both men and women that will be present in many of the activities over the next several months that we're having. We're looking at possibly doing a reunion of Black Brigade in September. There's many of our members that are not in the state of New Mexico anymore, a couple in California and a couple of other places. So there's a lot of activities coming up that we'll tend to try to keep you informed. Again, on our behalf, we would like to thank you very much for being here today. You mean as much to us as that documentary means to us in that history. So keep up your good work. And if we all keep up on a little bit of piece of work, then we can really make the kind of changes that we're all concerned about and we all want to participate in. So thank you to yourself for all the work that you've been doing in this time. I may have gotten older, but I may have gotten a little bit shorter.
We got any more questions? Anybody else got any comments they'd like to make?
Some people still would refer to us even as the Brown Berets, because there was some of our membership, Joaquin was in there, there was some of our other membership that were part of the Albuquerque Brown Berets. And the Brown Berets in Albuquerque did a terrific job, and it would be very, very highly respected for the contribution that they made. When we went to the Four Peoples campaign, and some of y'all referred to coming back from Denver and so on, there were several very quick things that were happening in those couple of years. And if you remember one, was the call for the Four Peoples Campaign in Washington by Baptist Martin Luther King. And so we were working on that as young people, organizing the New Mexico delegation to Washington, along with others throughout the state. The Black Braves were still not founded during that time. For some of us, coming back from the Four Peoples Campaign, spending a month and a half in Resurrection City in Washington and this kind of thing, afforded us a lot of time to talk about home and to look at the world and to see what's happening here and what should we be doing. And we spent a lot of time together on that campaign from here to Washington, and while we were there for security reasons and other ways, we had to stay very close, tight together from here to Washington, just because of the circumstances that were surrounding us in terms of security, the Ku Klux Klan, a lot of activity that was happening as we were moving forward to Washington. Then the combination really of what Santiago mentioned, coming back and then also going to the First Chicano Youth Conference, where we met members of the Young Lords, because there was others, although it was a Chicano Youth Conference. Well, every school, mid-school, or junior high in those days, and high school, there was a CYA or a Chicago Youth Association, and from the heights to the valley or whatever. So the combination of coming that together, and then us saying to ourselves that we need to do Mexico next, and this is from our opinion, okay? With no disrespect to our sisters and brothers in the ground race, because we still work with them, and we still work hand in hand, and we still do today, because there's still ground race chapters throughout this country. And so based upon that, we decided the need for us to Mexicalize our youth program was the ground, the history of what was to become the Black Beret organization in the hands of the community. And so all decisions that would be made in terms of programs or campaigns that we worked on would be rooted in the communities where our membership came from. And so then the combination of that and our studying and so on, based upon that, then our organization voted, our membership voted to become the Black Berets and to wear the Black Beret in honor of Ernesto Che Guevara when we speak. Because then we see ourselves not only as local, not only as state and regional and national, but international. And so based upon that, then we wanted to make our commitment to honor Che. And so we voted to wear Black Berets. That's a short kind of version of why we did it. Yeah, there was really no division. There was no division between the Black Berets. We didn't agree on anything, but I'm in agreement with that if I find me at home right now. But there was no separation or intentional separation between ourselves and the Brown Berets. That was not history speaks for itself, but even in our group, even more great, those were the Brown Berets.
Jay, I bet you none of this was recorded, unfortunately. Or hopefully. I do want to say that the video, at least this short piece, will be up on the Digital History Project. And if you haven't gone to it, I hope you will go to it. And I hope in time that people stop referring to this as the Office of the State Historian website. And it will be immersed in your Pueblo. And it will be, you can refer to it, that is our website. It's people's history. Because
right on.
And so this website will be there as a teaser, if nothing else, for a larger project and some of the biographies and it will be put around in there. So www.NewMexicoHistory.
Okay. Any more comments or insights or discussion points that anybody would like to make? Okay, let's go home and party. No. It must be the